Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Show your support for the Untold Radio Network family of shows and join in on the conversation by using super stickers and super chats on YouTube. Got a question you want answered? Ask it live via a super chat and get real time responses from our shows, knowledgeable hosts, and guests. Help keep the Untold Radio Network shows running strong. We need your support. Send your super chats and stickers now.
Hi there and welcome to Untold Radio. This is Down South Anomalies. I'm extremely excited and extremely freaked out. This is episode 29 and we have an actual visionary in our midst.
We do.
Can you pronounce this man's name properly for me?
You are dyslexic at times. It's Alex Proyas. And he is the director of...
so many astounding films. I mean, this man must have been aware that he was a cult director from day one.
Mm-hmm.
Spirits of the Air, Gremlins of the Clouds, The Crow, wrote, produced, directed Dark City, iRobot, Garage Days, The Knowing, The Gods of Egypt.
Yes.
This is Australia,
yep.
Sydney's Terrence Malick,
mm-hmm.
David Lynch,
mm-hmm.
Donald Cammell.
Mm-hmm.
This man
all rolled into one,
and we are so humbled and privileged to have him on our episode. Can you bring Mr. Perez in?
Here we go.
Alex, how are you? So glad to have you on Down South Anomalies.
Thank you for the lovely welcome. And yes, I did want to become a cult director. I'm actually almost disappointed. Well, I am actually bitterly disappointed if I ever make a movie that doesn't become a cult movie. Because I sort of set out to do that. So mm-hmm. nice of you to notice that.
Well, you know, that's something that is very difficult to achieve because I believe that the ingredients to become a cult director are basically defined by the audience. Mm-hmm. So even if you set out to do that, it doesn't mean you're going to become that person. But all your films have a sense of extraordinary longevity because of their absolute uniqueness.
I think it's because I was inspired by directors who are cult directors, you know. Jodorowsky and Louis Buñuel and Andrei Tarkovsky, David Lynch, you know, they're the filmmakers that I aspired to be like. And so I very naturally fell into making films, telling stories. I mean, I guess you got to be a little eccentric to start with, which helps, you know. But I very much wanted to emulate those filmmakers' work because I admired them so much. So I've pretty much done that in with everything that I've done. Even my most commercial work, I'm fundamentally an experimental filmmaker, as I think a lot of those filmmakers that I mentioned have been as well. So I like to bounce between around from genre to genre and try different things. I never want to make the same movie twice. I feel like, you know, there's enormous pressure by people who like your work and studio people and people who finance your work to just do the same thing all the time if you've had a success with it, and then never do the thing that you've had no box office success with. But I like to push myself and try different stuff every time because I get easily bored. I'm easily, you know, distracted and easily bored, and so I like to try new something that I haven't done. I don't quite know how to do, and play with that, you know, for a while.
So. Alex, I don't think you've emulated one of those directors we've spoken about. I think what you've done is you've cut a very unique path. And that makes us feel extremely honoured, especially if we're from native Australia, where you've ended up calling home for a long, long time. And all your films have an extraordinary uniqueness, but they seem to sort of slip into the world of the supernatural, the anomalous. I mean, even a film like Garage Days, to me, speaks highly about the whole esoteric notion of music and community, and really means a lot to me growing up in Sydney in my teenage years. I think I'm a little older than you, but they've run parallel to my life, and I've felt extremely proud that we have a visionary director in our midst. And when you initially started, you were doing all sorts of things, but you did some really pioneering film clips. Can I just ask you briefly about that? Were you involved with Jim Thirlwall screening Fetus Off the Wheel? And did you do Ricky's Hand? Was that right for Fag Gadget?
No, Ricky's Hand. I did a film, made a film with that as a soundtrack in film school.
Right.
Just because I like the track, you know, and we actually ended up reaching out to Daniel Miller of Mute Records, who released the track, you know, released and had a deal with Daniel Miller,
With Fag Gadget.
Yeah, Fag Gadget, but he's that chap, you know.
His name is blanking on me too.
Frank Tovey, yeah.
That's right, yes.
It's all in there somewhere. It's just a long time ago. You know?
It is. It's the download gets more and more difficult at times.
Yeah, that's right. And so he hadn't made a video. I mean, he was a very indie level person and he hadn't made a video. So he said, yes, you can use it for your film school project. And then we ended up sending it to them, and they loved it. They really loved the video. You know, it was just an sort of experimental time-lapse thing that we'd done. And I think they ended up using it. In fact, you know, years later, Frank Tovey passed away a while ago, and his daughter reached out to me and said, can I put it on his... They were doing like a video compilation of all of his music, and I said, absolutely. So it's the best possible way to make a music video, which didn't start off as a music video but became one.
And I'm glad you clarified that, because that has really gone out there and become a bit of mythology. So I'm glad to be clear about that. But I knew you'd resonate with such an exceptional, experimental, groundbreaking artist as Frank Tovey, that music today just sounds, his music from the 80s sounds to me as current as everything else. Now, you have some incredible initiatives that have gone up recently that run parallel alongside of Mystery Clock. And one of them is the Heretic Foundation. The other one is Vidiverse. And I would love to discuss extensively with you about Vidiverse. But before we get there, you and I met initially over a co-production you were doing with Oracle Pictures, Robert Reynolds and Victor Gentile, for a TV pilot called Conspiracy. And isn't it amazing, Alex, that no one really paid true attention to that pilot way back in the mid-90s, and now every streaming service out there is pulling out that notion of the skeleton of that TV series and turning it into something that's getting extremely high ratings. But the astounding thing for me was your interest in the world of possibly the anomalous and the conspiratorial. And I'm just very curious about how you feel about the recent news that has gone out there since 2017, where we're seeing names like the Mellon dynastic family appear forward and say that there is a genuine phenomena here with the UFO, the UAP, the ATIP, whatever you wish to call it. And also that recent shoot down in the States. Do you have a person, maybe you don't have a personal opinion about these incidents, but I'm just curious how you have perceived what's going on in terms of the public domain and information pertaining to the supposed anomalous flying object.
Well, it's very hard in our contemporary world to delineate the strata of conspiracies that are going on, you know, and particularly if you like the idea of exploring those possible conspiracies. Now there's a label for such people and they're put into this, you know, as there is a label for most categories of people now, and they're basically called conspiracy nutters or conspiracy theorists, and you know, it's not something that, you know, society embraces, that kind of, you know, paranoid, let's call it paranoid thinking. You know, I've been paranoid my entire life, you know. I had you know, scenarios that happened to me when I was quite young that made me that way, and I don't think of it as being paranoid. I think of it as just being questioning and being genuinely curious on how society and how government and how the world reality works, you know. Mm. So look, I have increasing difficulty. The older you get, the more you learn, the less you know, kind of thing. With the amount of information that we're bombarded with these days, it's very, very hard to pick the, you know, real conspiracies from the maybe false conspiracies. But there is a strata of them, and you know, my one theory I have is that the truly ridiculous conspiracies, like the flat Earth idea that some people seem to gravitate towards these days, I believe that's a conspiracy within a conspiracy. What I believe that is because I find it hard to believe that anyone is actually genuinely stupid enough to believe that the Earth is still flat, right? And I've sort of been in, I've been touched by that, those conspiracy nutters, because apparently I have this running motif in my films of the flat Earth, from Dark City to Gods of Egypt. You know, there is a running idea, but it's, trust me, I don't believe that the Earth is flat, you know. So I believe what that is a fabrication of a ridiculous conspiracy to take us, our minds off the real conspiracies that are clearly going on in our modern world and have been going on for some time, you know. Anyway, that's just one crazy theory.
No, you know what? We actually feel the same way. It's a bit of a wag the dog scenario, and a lot of people have labelled it as a psychop, and it seems so absurd that a society that was genuinely in the first quarter of the 20th century seen so foolish and ridiculous should end up becoming this mainstream motif. And it makes you wonder, if you go back to the original etymology of the word paranoia, I think
perception.
It means heightened perception.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, you know, I think the word conspiracy, we actually have to find another word for it, because initially all that was a great piece of investigative journalism. And you can actually cite documents out of intelligence services in the US as the blowback from the Kennedy assassination, and they would tell their operatives, when you're talking to the press, you need to make sure that when you use the word conspiracy, that you put theory on the end of it to devalue the research that's coming at you. And I think in many ways, we're just talking about the ability in a supposed democracy to question authority, and which amazes me in the height now of the Navy in the US saying that there may be some validity to these anomalous objects we're witnessing in the sky, that at the same time, we're actually seeing this whole notion of a threat being brought back up again into culture. I don't know if you know the late author Robbie Graham. We actually think we did the final interview with him in the world. He passed away only a few months ago. I think he unfortunately was suffering some depression, but he wrote this astounding book called Silver Screen Sources, which was a 10-year investigation into Hollywood. And it's an astounding book. I don't know if you're aware of this book. And for the first time ever, someone with genuine academic credentials did a very serious study of the way that films dealing with that information may actually have a knock at the door and a revision of their script or their production or a reworking of the final sequence of their film, said that, it, you know, this film is pinging on national security. And you've dealt with a lot of topics, especially iRobot. Have you ever had moments that you've found that you've stepped over the line and people want to come in and do a revision of your script or control your production for reasons of supposed national security?
No, that hasn't happened. No, because it's the studios on those types of productions, the studios are all over you anyway. There's a whole legal department that makes sure that you don't, that it, and it's more corporate stuff than top secret, you know, government information that you might be imparting, because we're not in a position to impart that anyway. The only anecdotal thing I've heard is when Kubrick was making Dr. Strangelove, they had a, I think FBI, CIA, someone paid them a visit because apparently the inside of the bombers, the B-52s, which they just kind of made up, they had no idea what the inside of a bomber looked like or how it functioned, how the tech functioned to drop bombs and all that sort of stuff. And apparently they stumbled upon something that was a little close for comfort, and they, you know, but again, it's like that's an anecdotal thing. I don't know whether there's any truth to that theory. But no,
I've heard that story as well. I think he was utilizing photographs out of Life magazine because he wasn't allowed access to that and got too close to the bone. Well, looks, let's have a look at Vidi versus the Outsiders from your, and then we'll talk about this astounding site for independent filmmakers, which in many ways has been so needed for so long. My breath is taken away when I see the material on that site and even what I see on your YouTube channel. Tell us about Vidiverse, Alex.
Vidiverse has been going for a little over a year, and it was it's a curated film platform, filmmakers platform. So I've so far picked all the films that end up on the site. Though I must say I'm getting to saturation point now, and I'm going to have to start relying on others to help me. Look, it's just me wanting to encourage indie filmmakers. It's predominantly short films, but we're getting an increasing number of features now. And these are films that they're just basically, I mean, my criteria is films that I like that I think are cool, that are doing something interesting. So it's all coming from my own aesthetic and my own desire to see clever filmmaking, you know, new ideas and original thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're not a genre specific, we cross genres. There is a tendency towards the fantasy and science fiction just because that's kind of the stuff that I like, but there's even documentaries there as well. And again, I say it's to encourage filmmakers because for me, it's like there's, you know, I've judged a bunch of film festivals around the world over the years, and through COVID, I was actually judging them via the internet, of course. And so I was aware of the quality of these amazing films that you never, other than doing the festival circuit, you know, you never see them. No one gets to see them. They just vanish into the, you know, the bottom drawer of the filmmaker's, you know, bedroom or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to give those films a platform because they're genuinely great. I mean, the quality is stunning. And having run Vidiverse now for a while, I'm blown away by, you know, filmmakers who make this stuff for like on the smell of an oily rag and do extraordinary stuff, not just in terms of brave visionary filmmaking, but even just the quality of the techniques used are incredible, you know. It's a way to get them seen, but it's also a way, we hope, to monetize these films, because other than putting them on YouTube or something like that, I mean, some get lucky enough to get some platform to buy them for a for a period of time, but they're not going to receive a lot of revenue, and that's not why the filmmakers are doing it. So we're trying to monetize the platform and make it. And you know, we've just sent out our first payments to our top tier viewed films, which isn't a lot of money, but it's more than they've received on YouTube. You know, put it that way.
So is this a world like anybody? Anybody can enter from all over the world. They don't have to be just from Australia. So it's a worldwide.
Yeah, no, anyway, it's a global thing, and anyone can enter. And we, you know, as I say, I try and see all the films that are entered because, of course, we have about 200 films at the moment. I think something like that. You know, there have been thousands of films.
Yeah, I bet.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's quite a challenge to.
We'll put the link up on for Vidiverse on this when it goes out, so people can go and check it, because it's a streaming platform for up and coming filmmakers. And you know, I had a look at it, and some of the, you know, just the read a bit and stuff, and it looked all pretty amazing.
Well, I think what it did to us, we initially thought, okay, we're going to dump two other services, and this is a very cheap service. I think it's less than $5 a month, or like $50 for the year.
Yeah, $44.
And it is so worthwhile. It's so inspirational. It's very egalitarian of you, Alex, and I think it's a profound thing, and it's truly needed, because the only thing that's going to change that system now is a sense of independence where people can operate in a creative space of true freedom. Do you, in a way, do you feel like, am I jumping the gun here? Have you turned your back on Hollywood in terms of what you're motivated through the Heretic Foundation now and Vidiverse? Is it something you've walked away from?
I haven't so much turned my back, but it's very kind of pragmatic what's happened over the last few years with COVID and not being able to travel and all that sort of stuff. It's all kind of come at the same time. And I've been spearheading this virtual production methodology because up until a few months ago, when AI has become this beast now. It was a very efficient way of making films. You can make them faster, and you understand the basic principle, which is you either project an LED screen behind the actors or a green screen, and you create the environments in a computer, mm-hmm. and then you track the camera to the computer, so live you can actually move the camera around and it all moves in perspective. So you can shoot very quickly. You can go from location to location, on the beach in the morning and on the mountain in the afternoon, or whatever the cliche is. And you can get a feature film or you can go to you can shoot it on the planet Mars, and there's no real cost differential for the sort of stuff that I do, which is world building. I like to build alternate realities for my films. That's one common thread they have. So it doesn't matter now whether I'm shooting on a beach or the planet Mars. It's all the same cost differential. So that's why it's a great and efficient way to work. That methodology, to get back to your question, that methodology means that I have a greater control over my destiny. So I'm now an indie filmmaker, like all the people that I'm promoting on Vidiverse. My mantra is we're indie now. I'm not a gun for hire as I was with the studios. And, even with those guys, Gods of Egypt was the biggest independent film made, but it was still a studio basically putting the production together. Now, because I've lowered the cost of production, I have complete autonomy with the stories I'm telling. And what I've said to my people, my peeps in LA, my Hollywood managers and agents, etc., is I don't want to read anyone's scripts. I don't want any scripts to come to me. I don't care, because quite frankly, the type of film that Hollywood can help me make, they don't want to make anymore. The large scale, visionary, original IP, which is what I do. I like to create a world and work out how it all looks and what the actors are going to be wearing and the sets would look like. That's dead. That is no longer exist. Now Hollywood is literally, and it's going to be fascinating when Marvel dies, because it looks like it's dying at the moment.
Wow.
I've been saying this for years. I've been saying that when Marvel goes, Disney are making a huge botch up of all their IP as well, the endless regurgitation of IP that they've made countless versions of. The luster of Marvel is going. So when that goes, there's nothing to replace it. There is nothing Hollywood is producing right now to replace it. And that's when the indie world is going to come into its own. And schmucks like me, who are building a new model of production from the ground up, which is exactly what I've been doing now for the last 4 or 5 years, and Heretic Foundation is at my virtual production studio is one part of that, one component of that. Vidiverse is another component of that. I hope that we will be embraced and we don't even really need to be embraced, because, as you can understand, if I can get Vidiverse to a level that I'm hoping we can get it to, which is a dedicated streamer that supports individual filmmakers' brands, that's the next tranche of what we're building the site to do. My brand is part of the Vidiverse brand, as well as all the other filmmakers. We don't need Netflix. We don't need any of these other big-time players, to happily show my commercial content, my Gods of Egypt and whatever, and yet I receive no residuals as a filmmaker.
Oh, that's frightening.
The streamers do not pay a cent of residual. So the streamers have killed the home video market, which was the DVD. The Blu-rays, which is where that's what allowed filmmakers like me to survive between movies, because we'd get a stipend from all the video sales. If we had a successful movie, like I lived off iRobot for for a few years. I didn't have to rush into making another movie because I was being paid by residuals. Well, that's gone, right? That model has disappeared. So we have to build, you know, saying I'm turned my back, well, it's more that the commercial concerns of Hollywood have turned their back on filmmakers like me and many other filmmakers and made it literally impossible for us to survive within their framework. And it's kind of because they know their framework's dying. You know, they're more desperate and paranoid about the world than I am, you know. And then this AI thing is like, man, that's Armageddon right there. We just hope that we can, as nimble indie filmmakers, we can ride that wave more successfully than the legacy, you know, content creators.
Well, a
rambling answer to your question.
No, it wasn't. That was a great answer, and I'm really thankful for that insight. And I also believe that, you know, the audience will find you. That audience is nowhere near as stupid as what the mainstream mind thinks they are.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ah, and they at times will be searching for material that has a certain edge to it and a uniqueness to it. And in many ways, an independent production is the only way that's going to be achieved. And I think you've actually really thought out the future very well. If anyone's going to approach AI from a constructive perspective, it's people with your imagination. It's like being a jazz musician. You have to have the foundation stones before you can improvise with this technology. Mm. If you go in there blind and think that you can make something out of it, well, you're going to find it's not going to work for you at all. And just like every uplift technologically we get, you know, there is the challenge to guide yourself between the yang and yin of it, the black and white of it. And I think what you've done is not set out to just do a platform for yourself, but for all these other independent filmmakers worldwide. And we totally applaud that. I think it's an astounding achievement.
Well, thanks. Thank you. And my ego isn't quite big enough to build a platform exclusively for myself. But, you know, we
I think you deserve to at times. I mean, the wife and I...
It's for filmmakers by filmmakers because it's coming at it from the perspective of what would I want as a platform to support me and show my work, and that's what I've built, and that will hopefully service everyone, you know. Mm-hmm. And this whole notion of promoting the filmmaker, because, you know, YouTube doesn't do that for filmmakers. Yeah. You know, you might, as a filmmaker, putting on, unless you're a influencer or doing podcasts or whatever, that's a whole other industry as far as I'm concerned, but if you're a storyteller, if you're a narrative storyteller in film, you might have a channel. And I tried this. You know, I've been experimenting over the years. I had a channel that had dramatic content, had a lot of my short films on, and I ended up pulling it all and putting it onto Videoverse, pulling it off YouTube, because you might get one video that does really well. But of course, the algorithm on YouTube is increasing over the years, being designed to not help your channel but help your individual film in order to maximize revenue, maximize advertising revenue, which is all they give a shit about, basically.
Of course.
And so it doesn't help the filmmaker. It's like one film might make you some dollars if you have a few million views or whatever, but it will literally not help your other films, you know. And so, again, you know, we're not building sustainable careers for filmmakers. You know, I hope one day in some golden age soon, and as AI brings the price of creation down and down and down and can focus it down into like the individual filmmaker, you know, someone's going to be able to churn out IP, their own IP, their own content that they've created, and actually they could be short films or whatever, and they'll make a dollar out of it. They'll actually be able to sustain a lifestyle, you know, which is all we really want. All exploitable filmmakers, all we really care about is we don't want to be rich. We just want to be able to make our next film, you know. So, again, that's what Vidiverse is trying to lock into, you know.
And we know people already independently up there like Brendan Young. That's very inspirational for them slogging away against that circuit out there that is in many ways embryonic of people like Alvin Toffler. You know, we're in the age of information overload, and how does something actually stand out when 90% of it is just noise attached to a signal that's got nothing to actually inspire us to go further than to feel like we're drowning in a deluge of digital media. So I think that Vidiverse is an astounding thing. Now, I just want to pop up that showreel of Alex's and we'll have a little word about this astounding film career. Just yes, thank you. Just so breathtaking and beautiful. I love the way that you edited that together. I love the way that your material filmically always flows to me. It's like a beautiful stream that just has such consistency and continuity and brilliance in its imagining. Now, the wife and I were very irate, and I must say this as well, because we're great lovers of the gods of Egypt. And we thought that was one of the most courageous and incredible reworkings of that early history. And Asper, you went to Greek school.
Yes, I did.
And those gods to you were not just an imaginary thing.
No, they weren't. They were supposed to be, that was our, you know, that was Greek history. So, you know, but, you know, everybody has their own take and their own interpretation of yeah. you know, those stories. So, you know, having made something like that, I actually loved The Gods of Egypt. I thought it was
thank
a fabulous
you.
Film.
Thank
you. And, you know, I really enjoyed it.
I'm Greek Egyptian myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was born in Egypt, and mm-hmm. my father's side goes back to Ptolemy and Alexander and etc. Because the Mediterranean is a mixing
yes.
of all that whole area, as you'd know.
Absolutely.
And in fact, in September, I'm being honoured in Egypt. They're flying me over, and I'm being honoured as a lost son of Egyptian filmmaking, which is fascinating to me.
Right.
Congratulations.
Very much looking forward to it. Because I haven't been back since my parents left the country. In fact, the Egyptian government actually owes my dad some money, so I'm hoping to.
Are you collecting?
No, I was saying that would be a great way to create a whole incident, a faux pas, and be. So I could just say, "Hey, you owe my dad some money, which you
yeah, right,
him when he left yeah. the country." But yeah, so the Gods of Egypt for me. I mean, I love Ray Harryhausen, and it was kind
of course
Ray Harryhausen, the film, but it was also because my granddad used to draw pictures. He was a great artist. He was one of the people in my family who encouraged me to be artistic. And as a kid, he used to draw these amazing drawings of those gods. And that's what really inspired me. And because, as you'd also know, the names of the gods that we use in the film are actually Greek names and
yes.
not the
yeah.
original Egyptian names, you know.
Yeah,
It's because those cultures are just so interlocked.
Intermeshed, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So for me, the immense disappointment was that the film and the whole approach behind making this wonderful fantasy mythological piece was by the political means in the US subverted into this example, this scapegoat for the racial politics that were going on at the time.
Ridiculous.
And yeah,
I was saying to the you know, when this first hit the project before we released, my response was to the studio, just let me go on TV. I'm Egyptian, you know, and I'm pretty pale. I was certainly a lot pale in those days. And there's this whole, as you might know, there's this whole kind of mythology that has been created where people honestly believe that ancient Egyptians were, sub-Saharan black Africans, you know.
Yes, yeah.
And they're just, I mean, that's not true, but in the US that's an adopted politically correct standpoint, you know. So anyway, it was infuriating, and it was literally the moment when, and this was going on when like Trump was running for to get into the primaries or whatever they call it. So it was like the perfect storm was going on. Oscars So White and all that sort of stuff. So literally, my film just, you know, it was perfect timing. I couldn't have timed it better for what went down in that film, you know, which is a horrible thing to go through when you see your movie being kind of derailed and cancelled
for the wrong reasons
after 2 years of spending your life making this thing and being quite proud of it. Actually, I thought it was actually a really good movie, and then all the criticisms that were leveled against it were ones that were, I mean, when you read reviews, and I don't often read reviews, I was in this instance just because I really wanted to hear what people were saying.
Sure.
You read reviews of your work and you're always struck by the fact that it's like they're reviewing another film, right? Because any reviewer is saying, they're seeing the film in their head. They're not seeing what's on the screen, and they're judging it accordingly. That's what reviewers seem to do.
Sure.
But this, in this instance, it really was like I was on an alien planet. Like what they were saying about the film, I'm like, well, no, that's not what happened. And to me, that was just really, for me, it was like a nail in the coffin of America's culture went off the rails. For me, it was going off the rails before that, but that's when I finally opened my eyes. And, you know, I don't live there, so I'm seeing it via the media, but that's when I really went, wow, this is really... The division between the left and the right is so extreme now that nothing can bring this back, right? Nothing.
No.
And here we are years later. We're 6 years later now, and it's literally even worse, right?
Yeah.
To the point where Trump's now reappearing, and it's like, you know, I just, you know, the only rationale for all that stuff is what they have is so bad. For people to be seriously thinking that Trump is the answer to their problems, what they have, it must be so fucking bad that, you know, they're clutching at any straws. But it's literally that division between the left and the right, the Republicans and the Democrats, that's drifted so far apart and nothing will reunite that.
There's nothing, bring them back. But, I mean, I had what was that film that Brad Pitt starred in as a Greek? I can't even remember. What was it back?
Troy, right?
It was Troy. I didn't even see it because I was like, how Greek is Brad Pitt? Like, seriously.
And yet no noise around that signal.
Well, you know.
And you know what? The astounding thing is for us being back here in Sydney and seeing that film.
I didn't see it.
One of our friends, Johnny, is one of the first people to appear. And he's not a native Australian at all. And
in the gods of Egypt.
It's a moment of absolute pride.
Yeah.
That you go, wow, look at this extraordinary epic. And you know what? I was forced into the role of a film critic myself. And I said to them, when they finally offered me the role on the SBS movie show, I said, I don't want to be a critic. I'm more obsessed with human failure. I'm obsessed with B-grade to Z-grade films that, against all odds,
people are making,
have maintained that David and Goliath effect. Mm-hmm. And these people still have remained true to their vision, even if the boom mic does appear for a few frames.
Who cares?
And so I think that the notion to me is ignorance. And didn't these people ever have a good look at Clash of the Titans or the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad? Where is their film history? Where is their ideology lay? And where does the notion of true fantasy come in and affect their dialectic? I think that they shouldn't be given the air to breathe at times. And that was an incredibly courageous production that is absolutely entertaining from start to finish.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, thank you for saying so. Yeah, and I agree. I think it's a fun film. It was designed to be fun. It wasn't designed to be a political statement or anything, you know. And my notion of casting, I mean, I embrace the notion of casting different. I mean, casting a Scotsman with that ridiculous accent that Gerard Butler has, which I couldn't get him to shake. I was like, whatever. I mean, it's like as an Egyptian, it doesn't bother me. And you know, it's like I had all, you know, Elodie Young is a Cambodian. She's a French Cambodian. So I, you know, tried to get the worldwide ethnicities in there. I tried to cover all bases, you know. Mm-hmm.
Haven't they ever watched a sword and sandal film out of Europe? I mean, have you seen what goes on there?
No, of course. Yeah,
and there were hundreds of them.
Yeah,
and they're so remarkable. Yeah. You know, one thing about you as a director and your creative vision, and, you know, I'll go to the example of Dark City. Dark City was so ahead of its time, yet it paid homage to what had gone beforehand. And I think that look at the bastardization of the Men in Black motif that happened years later with the Will Smith films, let alone Dark City already had investigated that incredibly rich world of that sort of anomalous character, that shadow figure, that figure that floats into the room. There was so many, it was a bit like communion for me. And I'm very interested in the real material behind communion with the Streber's story.
It's a great film. Yeah.
But Dark City did that. It actually hit some sort of raw nerve inside of me. And I could see those motifs, those archetypes were part of my deep subconscious. And you were the first director to actually touch on that for me. That was really
It's weird that you mentioned communion because I hadn't really thought of it until you just said it, but it is actually probably an influence to Dark City. The book more than the film, in fact, because I read the book before I saw the film. I remember being really that moment in the book where he goes, where he's talking about a trip to Paris, right?
Right.
A holiday that he spent in Paris, and then he works out that he didn't go to Paris during that time. So he was somewhere else, obviously. Mm. And that actual idea has stayed with me to this day. I'm still using that idea because I just found it so disturbing. I'm actually working on a Dark City series at the moment, and we're doing that. I've just realized just now, I use exactly the same idea in the early parts of the Dark City series, where the now hero, she's the daughter of Rufus Sewell and Jennifer Connelly, and it's a direct sequel of the movie, but 20 odd years later. Mm-hmm. And she talks to she's a school teacher, and she talks to her kids, and they're talking about Paris, and she realizes in that class that she's never, you know, she can speak French and all that sort of stuff, and she realizes she's never actually been there, and she doesn't know why she's never been there, you know.
Right.
And so, to me, it's just such a haunting idea, you know.
And in a sense, that embodies that whole notion of that hauntology that we've been investigating, those mm-hmm. images that stay in people's minds from popular culture and remain as this sort of sigil mm-hmm. that affects everything about them and including their creativity. Now, let me just digress a little bit here. And we are very curious to ask you questions about things that might have influenced you early in the piece. And we have a great love for television, especially in that stage where incredible cinematographers like Conrad Hall and Gert Oswald directors were coming on to series like Outer Limits. Mm-hmm. And really, behind Stefano and Leslie Stevens, were actually trying to make feature films within that hour television frame. Were you influenced by things like that? Did television touch your heart growing up in Sydney?
Without any question. I mean, Outer Limits and Twilight Zone were the two sort of main television influences in an era where really it was either those or Gilligan's Island, for God's sake, or the Brady yes. Bunch, whatever the hell crap they would put on after school, we get all the stuff. And then I would stay up really late to watch The Outer Limits, The Twilight Zone that was being replayed. And then they'd like run a few episodes and then they'd take it off because they didn't think anyone was watching, you know. And the other show that I loved as a kid was Star Trek as well, the original Star Trek.
Wow.
And that one, I remember that one was always on at 4 o'clock on an Sunday afternoon. And so I had endless, my family being very sociable, they'd always go out with a bunch of friends and they go to the beach and have a big meal and whatever, being Greek, Egyptians, etc. That's the sort of stuff they do. And I'm like, I've got to get home to watch Star Trek. This is before the VCR was invented. Yeah. Like, I've got to get home. It's like I'm going to miss the first 15 minutes. And they're like, you know, settle down, young lad, you know.
To hear that. I would love to play you a little piece from a Stefano written episode, Obit. And let's just see, for the viewers and the listeners that are unaware of this incredible anthology series, there is a great digital box set out there. You need to get the Blu-ray. Mm. It is so remarkable. But let's have a look at this and take into consideration AI and technologically where we are now. I think this is the first time ever on the small screen that it was alluded that 1984 premise that they are watching us perpetually.
Machines are everywhere. Oh, you'll find them all, your obsessed people. And you'll make a great sound, smashing a few of them. But for everyone you destroy, hundreds of others will be built. And they'll demoralize you, break your spirits, create such rifts and tensions in your society that no one will be able to repair them. Oh, you're a savage, despairing planet. And when we come here to live, you friendless, demoralized flotsam will fall without even a single shot being fired. Senator, enjoy the few years left you. There is no answer. You're all of the same dark persuasion. You demand, insist on knowing every private thought and hunger of everyone, your families, your neighbors, everyone but yourselves.
And against
all odds. I think I need to rewatch that one.
Against all odds, Alex, you can see there that Stefano fighting the system that, you know, already the sponsors were tying down desperately. Mm. And he would actually have to write really extreme things in his script, get those pieces removed for those other insights to remain in that episode. Mm. But he's screaming at us really what's literally happening today. And I think that that's the proud, profound thing about imaginative cinema and directors like yourself, that they can actually give us an inkling of what the future will be.
Yeah, and look, that's great to see that clip. I haven't watched any of those shows for a while, but my good friend David Scow, who wrote The Crow, in fact, and we've done a lot of stuff in the past, he's an absolute authority on the Outer Limits. In fact, he's written a couple of definitive books about the Outer Limits. You know, the amazing thing about those shows is literally at the time, I mean, movies weren't doing anything nearly as challenging. That was in an era when TV was safer than the movies, but that little clip that you showed us and pretty much the whole series, I mean, the movies weren't doing anything like that. You know, science fiction in the movies, that's 60s, right? That's
early 60s. What was it, 64?
Yeah, early 63, 64.
I mean, movies, science fiction movies in the 60s were a bit of a no man's land, you know. They were a bit of a wasteland. You know, I mean, it's not...
They were driving fodder. They were driving fodder then.
It's only a few years after, like, Forbidden Planet, which was...
Actually, that was before.
But, I mean, that's... You look at that film. I tried to watch it again recently. I tried to show it to my daughter, and it's pretty hilariously cheesy. I mean, it's bad.
They had a lot of restrictions brought on that production, but I still think it's a very profound film, even just in its set design and primarily the Lewis and B.B. Barone score.
Yeah,
which conceptually I agree, but
yeah,
and thematically I agree, but in terms of its execution, I mean, it's pretty painfully inept. The the sexual dynamics that are going on
for sure
are pretty hilarious, I mean, much worse than I remembered, and that made it impossible. And my daughter thought it was ridiculous. And she's, you know, she's 14 years old, and she's grown up on Alfred Hitchcock movies and everything else from that era. So she's a young person who loves black and white movies, doesn't care. Like, we showed her 12 Angry Men, Sydney Lumet's 12 Angry Men recently, which she was reading the book in school and she thought it was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, not many teenagers you could do that with. It's just because I've conditioned her over the years to like great movies, whether they're black and white or got old-fashioned actors in them or whatever. It's about the movies.
And it's a movie with a script-driven...
We do that extensively with our grandchildren at a very early age. We make sure that before they go to sleep at night that they are watching black and white films or black and white television.
Yeah.
So they're not going to have that sort of corrupted perception.
Of like, oh, that's black and white, I don't watch that.
That a lot of these film critics write from that corrupted perception. They're never able to step outside of themselves and realise, hold on, I think what I'm talking about here is myself. Mm. And just like that great line from Cronenberg's Videodrome, that the cathode ray is the cathode ray is the retina of the mind's eye.
Yeah.
I've always thought that cinema is that reflecting mirror that is a retina. We are so honored, humbled, and astounded to have you on this podcast. Now, this podcast comes out of the height of anomalous research in the US. Now, also, quickly, just before we end, I just wanted to have a look at this. I've always had a bit of an obsession, and I was an experimental musician back in the piece. I worked with Graham Revell, who you know scored Sin City, and he had a band called SPK, a very notorious noise band.
Yeah, I know Graham. Graham scored The Crow as well.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, I slipped up on that. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I don't know where I was going, but I can remember performing in the early 80s at Art Unit, and someone did a piece on Francis Bacon, which was all involving his three obsessions: war, meat, and the dictator. These fascinate me, these little segments you've got up on YouTube for people to be inspired by. Let's have a look at Francis Bacon's Hotel, I think it is. I just love the music there too. That wasn't Peter Miller there, was it?
I don't know who did the music. It's a off the shelf bought piece of music. There are these sites now that have great music on them, and you license them basically for.
Oh, right, yeah.
But I'm glad you showed that because that's literally I haven't seen it since I did it, and that's my early days when Midjourney. I started first playing with Midjourney, and it's amazing how it's developed, you know, and literally for me, I was wrestling with the notion that we are, AI is basically being used to repurpose whatever, recycle, plagiarize other artists' work. And so I literally, that's why I said Francis Bacon's Hotel, because that's what I was prompting. I was prompting Francis Bacon. And I wanted it to be clear that that's what I was doing. And that's why I say I'm just the curator. AI put it together. Mm-hmm. I probably shouldn't say AI is the creator, but made by AI or whatever the hell I said. But this is, me coming to grips with, and I made a series of these short films, me coming to grips with the notion of what this thing was and then how I can use it where I can feel justified as another artist using someone else's work, cut to only, I mean, that's like only 6 months old or maybe it's less than a year old, right?
Right.
Yeah.
How far it's progressed and how many lawsuits there are going on right now about Midjourney and all the other platforms. But also, like, we are now using AI as a fundamental part, as you need to, because it's as I say, it's coming on. It's here. It's a major.
It's the way of the world now.
It's going to change everything. It already has changed everything.
Yeah.
And so we have to use it in our workflow, but we're using it guided by human hands, and we're only prompting IP that is public domain, that it's mm-hmm. beyond the you know, and if anything emerges that we can spot that the AI is doing behind our back, so to speak, that's something that is relevant to today's culture, we nix it, we don't use it, mm-hmm. because it's a huge issue right now, you know. So I'll prompt my own work if I want a particular thing, which actually works really well, because stylistically you set up an approach, and if you prompt your own work, I feel completely fine with doing that, ripping myself off, you know. prompting, as I say, stuff that's 100 years old or whatever, that's not, hopefully not going to, you know, mess anyone up if they see it. Mm-hmm.
Of course it's not. And I think one of the most important thing is that we have to embrace this technology and make it work in the most positive way for us, because there's no avoiding it now.
No.
And we can always...
Well, with everything, if you're not on board with what's coming out and is current, then you're going to get left behind. That's all. You have to keep reinventing yourself and keeping up with, you know, the new technologies. Otherwise, you're gone.
No, I was, the WGA, I'm a member of the WGA Writers Guild of America, and they're on strike at the moment. And one of their issues they have, amongst many other issues, particularly streaming, which is, not paying residuals, they're still holding firm. Is the advent of AI and their concern about how their members will be affected by studio execs using the AI on ChatGPT or whatever to
write
their own scripts, you know. Now, that's true. That will happen. But my and so, therefore, WGA members will lose work, you know. But my point is, my own selfish perspective is that I really don't care, because the work that may be replaced by AI is not work that I'd ever want to do or anyone would ever hire me to do, which is write another season of a successful TV series that's been running for 10 years where they have multiple scripts they can feed in. Mm-hmm. To the AI, and then the AI will probably do a serviceable job of regurgitating something and good enough for the, you know, that the audience don't really care, you know. Mm. But in terms of coming up of me getting what's in my brain out onto a page and explaining it to a bunch of other human beings, collaborators, to make an original piece that hopefully doesn't exist outside of, you know, my head initially, mm-hmm. I still hold that in as high an esteem as I ever have.
Absolutely.
Even with AI, even with me, as I say, prompting my own work to focus in on a particular image or idea, it's still, to me, no more than I would have done in the past. What the end product will be is, yes, it will help. AI will help it, expedite it, streamline it, improve it. But the fundamental soul of that idea is something that I believe artists are in tune with. Some, I don't know, is it a cosmic force? Is it a spiritual entity? I don't know what it is, but I know that the connection that I have with that source, that muse outside of my own psyche, it ain't AI.
No.
Put it that way, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the grand AI, if we're all living in some kind of artificial construct, which some people believe we are anyway, you know.
Mm. Well, I don't know if it's so much the simulation, but cosmologists and neurologists now are considering that they can actually cite neurologically for our motor skills, you know, in the various hemispheres of the cerebellum, but they're believed in that consciousness may exist outside of the body. And so it's that notion of drawing from the Akashic record or the source field, or academics like Rupert Sheldrake would say the morphogenic field out there.
Yeah.
And when you look at dark matter, which makes up 60% of the known universe, now we've got the James Webb telescope out there showing us what looks like sinews when it looks deeply into dark matter. I don't think it's a long stretch to say that we all seem to be drawing. We're like receivers. And that's the most profound way to do it. I mean, pre-AI, as Hollywood burns itself and eats itself, it's been running in parallel anyway. I mean, you're not going to do a remake of Bewitched, are you? You're not going to end up doing one of those franchises that's just we're going back to something that we feel is successful and then possibly destroy it completely. But iRobot, I just remembered, was an episode of the second season of Outer Limits, which is quite astounding, starring Leonard Nimoy. Now, I'd like to go back to pre this whole notion of the technology around us and just get quickly your opinion on a 10-second, 16mm film from Bluff Creek. This is the original Patterson and Gimlin film, supposedly showing us a parallel hominid that exists. And, of course, Alex, there's a lot more footage than that. But what did you – have you got an assumption, an opinion about that Patterson-Gimlin footage?
I never bought it even before it was enhanced, and now even less so. I've never seen it enhanced, but it's
– You never believe that to be real.
Well, it's just that, you know, having studied movement of human beings as much as I have you know, when we're doing iRobot and now we're doing this other project called RUR and we're talking about the efficiencies of robotic movement and how far it's come with, you know, the Boston Dynamics robots, et cetera, now that really are so much more amazing than the robots we came up with in iRobot that were supposed to be set in 2030-something, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And here we are and we've exceeded. And we were dealing with, like, we were talking to MIT at the time when we were researching iRobot. And a lot of those people, engineers, whatever they're called, actually went on to work at Boston Dynamics and actually built these fuckers when we were talking about what they could do. And they were like, oh, no, it's not going to be till... So even they didn't know, right? Those guys didn't know. Going back to the movement of that piece of footage, I just don't buy that's a guy in a suit. Just it doesn't... The way the fur is moving or not moving to me says it's not that the fur is not attached to muscle and skin structure. It's free floating. You look at the back and you see that it doesn't move the way it would if it was connected to his muscle structure, right? And that's the best thing I can say. Even though he's like making effort to like hunch over and stuff, I just don't buy it as a real interesting creature.
Well, you know what? The jury is still not in on that footage. And in the States, and I'm just going to show you a tiny piece of a campaign that Doug Hycheck's doing at the moment. He's trying to actually get a documentary up where science will go in. And let's just have a look.
In the depths of our world's most remote and uncharted forests, an enigma has captivated the hearts and minds of people for generations. Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti. This legendary creature has been known by many names, but its existence remains one of the greatest mysteries of our time. Now we invite you on a thrilling journey into the unknown with Legend Meets Science 2, a groundbreaking documentary that will change every...
Okay, well, Doug Hycheck has a campaign, a Kickstarter up there, and it's got 5 days left. And, you know, the interesting thing that's always touched me, Alex, is the eyewitness testimony to all this world of anomalous experience. And I want science to come on board, but I want those narratives to remain free, to be what they are in a world where there's not ridicule. But we need to actually define what is reality and what isn't. Asper and I cannot thank you enough for your time this morning. We're very humbled and honored to have you in our midst. And when I wrote to you, I said, my God, I think I am punching way beyond my weight here to even ask for your time, because I know it's so valuable. But
no, it's a pleasure, Jamie. And look, I because I know you and I know the level of intelligence that you approach all this wonderful world with, I'm very, very happy to do it. And thank you. It's been great fun.
Well, you've been an inspiration to all of us, Alex, and we're so proud to have you as a native Sydneysider and someone we can call a colleague and even a friend. And I just think what you're doing is not just empowering your own vision, but you're empowering the planet to be able to approach the future in a constructive way and still remain with some artistic integrity in your heart. And your partner and your child, I just wish the best for you and the most powerful, potential-filled future.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that, over the years we've watched so many short films. We've been attached to all kinds of film festivals, and the short film usually goes up to make up these film festivals, no matter what kind of film festival it is. And, you know, they get made and then they're forgotten about. There isn't a platform for them to be on there and shown and for people to access whenever they need to or want to. And especially nowadays with, people's attention span being so short, short films should be, you know, king.
Yeah.
So you creating this platform for short filmmakers and to be able to showcase them is actually a really much needed and much, a long coming feature. So thank you for that, for Vidiverse.
And thank you for everything, Alex. And we just wish you all the power in the world. And you know what? Your creativity will just go on to inspire us all. You are one of the most profound and unique directors, we believe, on the planet. And thank you for being part of this broadcast of Down South Anomalies.
Cheers, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Well, we will be back next week with another fascinating, I'm sure.
It'll podcast. Never get better than this, but don't tell them that. All right.
And so, all right. Okay. So, yep. See you next week. And
take care, Alex, and all the best to your family.
All right.
And remain safe.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Bye, everyone.